At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Kaiser Family Foundation Presents King v. Burwell Decision. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. Larry Levitt, you may begin your conference.
Thanks. I'm Larry Levitt, and thanks to everyone for joining us. Today's decision is obviously less complicated than it might have been if it had gone a different way, so I'm just going to make a few quick points and then open it up for questions of me and my colleagues here. First, I think there's little doubt at this point that the Affordable Care Act is here to stay, but it's equally certain that the partisan divisiveness over the law will continue. A key aspect of the decision is that it leaves no wiggle room for a future administration that might have wanted to end the ACA subsidies, but there's still a lot that the next president could do to shift the law left or right. While the ACA is not likely to be central to the 2016 election, the outcome of the vote could have major consequences for the law. Eventually, the debate will evolve to a discussion of how to improve the law, and reasonable people can and certainly will disagree over how best to do that. Now, the health law is doing what it set out to do so far, but it's still controversial, and there are plenty of challenges ahead. With that, let me introduce who is here when we're in California and in D.C. and open it up for questions. We have a phalanx of Kaiser experts to cover any angle you might conceivably be interested in. We have Molly Brody, Gary Claxton, Karen Politz, Jennifer Tolbert, Mary Beth Musemichi, and Cynthia Cox. And Drew Altman, the CEO of Kaiser, had hoped to join us as well, but like many of us, he assumed the decision would come down on Friday or Monday and is on a plane. So I'd encourage everyone to take a look at his column on the decision, which is now running on the Wall Street Journal think tank page. So with that, we'd be happy to take any questions.
At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Your first question comes from the line of Robert King with Washington Examiner. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. Can you elaborate a little bit more on how the ruling kind of binds the future administration from ending ACA subsidies?
Sure. Mary Beth, you want to take that one from the legal perspective?
Sure. This is Mary Beth Musumeci. And so what the court does is essentially avoid the Chevron test. So the Chevron test is the two-step analysis that they traditionally use to interpret statutes, and it asks whether the language is clear and or ambiguous, and then the second step is whether the court should defer to the agency. And here, the court sort of does what's called Chevron Step Zero, which is before one and two, and it says, we don't think this is an appropriate issue for the agency to decide at all. This is such a weighty political and economic issue, and Congress did not expressly delegate it to the agency, and we would have expected that Congress would have done that if they wanted to leave such a big decision to the agency. So we are not going to worry about deferring to the agency, and instead we are going to, as the court, do our job of saying what the law is, and we are going to interpret the statute. And so then the court engages in that analysis, and it finds that the language is ambiguous and read in the context of the law with these interlocking provisions, it finds that the interpretation should be to uphold subsidies in all marketplaces. If the court had asked the question about whether there should have been deference to the agency, that would have left the door open potentially for another administration running that agency to say, okay, this is ambiguous language and we have a different reasonable interpretation. But instead, the court spoke definitively and said, this is what the law means.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Tammy Luby with CNN Money. Your line is open.
Thanks for holding this. Are there any other court cases or anything working its way up that we need to know about other than the Boehner and the cost-sharing subsidies case?
Mary Beth, you're up again.
Sure. So there is a challenge to the contraceptive coverage requirement that is continuing to percolate up on behalf of the nonprofit employers. There was the Hobby Lobby decision, which covered the for-profit employers, but that is still out there. We don't see, however, any really broad fundamental challenges to the law. You know, the contraceptive coverage controversy is focused on one provision, and so this decision today is a pretty clear affirmation that the law is here to stay, you know, unless Congress was to do something.
Okay, and what is the crux of the Boehner challenge? Where does that stand?
This is Mary Beth again. I'm not certain where that stands right now. I think that there's not been a decision on standing yet.
Okay, thank you.
Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press *1 on your telephone keypad. Your next question comes from the line of Andy Davis with the Arkansas Democracy Gazette. Your line is open.
Hey, this is Andy Davis with the Arkansas Democratic Gazette. Arkansas is, at least at the moment, moving toward a state-based exchange. And just wondering, now that the funding, I guess, is no longer available for additional states to establish exchanges, what are the possibility of more states to move to the state-based exchanges?
This is Larry. I'll give a quick answer, and then if anyone else wants to jump in as well. I mean, I think if the decision had gone a different way, we certainly would have seen states scrambling to set up state exchanges to keep the subsidies flowing. But I think if anything, given the finality of this decision, we may see states moving in the other direction. I mean, there are some state exchanges that are struggling with their operations and with achieving financial sustainability, and this decision makes clear that the subsidies will flow to the residents regardless. So, you know, it wouldn't surprise me to see some states deciding to go the route of places like Oregon, New Mexico, Nevada, Hawaii, where they may play a role in running part of the exchange but leave the difficult enrollment and eligibility part to healthcare. .gov. And as you said, the financial challenges are substantial for any state wanting to set up its own exchange at this point. The early states had the benefit of significant federal grant funds for startup, and those have now ended. So any state wanting to set up its own exchange has to really do it on its own financially. And certainly, you know, there were two states that had, in addition to Arkansas, that had indicated that they were they had moved ahead with planning and had a conditional approval to set up an exchange: Pennsylvania and Delaware. And I believe Pennsylvania already announced today that they're not going to go ahead given the decision. Anyone else want to add anything?
Your next question comes from the line of Ryan Sanchetta with Bloomberg. Your line is open.
Hi, guys. Thanks for setting this up. I just have a question about the presidential campaign moving forward, and how you think today's ruling might affect the way candidates frame their candidacy.
Particularly around health care.
Sure. We only talk about healthcare, so that part's easy. This is Larry. I'll start. If the decision had gone the other way, I think it would have. If the decision had gone the other way, the ACA would have been a central issue in the campaign. Given that the court found for the government, I certainly think the ACA will be debated in the campaign, but I don't think it'll be a central issue. I think particularly in the Republican primary, I would expect candidates to reach out to their bases, or candidates to try and energize their bases by opposing the ACA. But I would expect the kind of political temperature on the law to diminish over time. Now, the fact that it may not be a big issue in the campaign doesn't mean that the campaign doesn't have consequences. There are a number of issues on the horizon. that have yet to be implemented, like the Cadillac tax on high-cost plans. Certainly there are opportunities for the next president and Congress to shift the law left or right. So I think the election certainly has consequences for the future of the law, even if it's not a central issue in the campaign. I don't know if Molly wants to add anything about kind of how she sees public opinion playing out.
I think what I would just say, I'm Molly Brody, and I direct the public opinion here, as I'm being reminded by people in the room. The public was not paying any attention to this law, or to this case. We were all paying a lot of attention, clearly, but the public wasn't. And I don't, we're going to do a tracking poll, and we'll find out quickly whether people heard about the outcome and whether they knew what came from it. But, you know, I'll remind everybody on the call who's seen our five-year trend on public opinion on the law. You know, it's been parallel horizontal lines forever, and, you know, nothing over the last 5 years shifted opinion much, not to midterm elections, not a presidential election, certainly not the first Supreme Court case. The only time we saw any movement in public opinion on the law had to do with the botched rollout, but then that even came back to what we had seen initially. I think that we do go back in some ways just to the normal partisan divisiveness that this law has always had. And I think that will be persistent and consistent, and that's what we'll hear throughout the campaign.
Great. Next question?
Thank you.
Oh, sure.
Your next question comes from the line of Kathleen McGrory with Tampa Bay Time. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you so much for having the call. Back to the legal issues. I mean, I'm wondering if you guys expect to see any larger legal challenges down the line, you know, aside from what's kind of out there in the ether already, or if this one is pretty final and you think that would deter, you know, future folks from trying to mount a legal challenge.
Mary Beth, do you have a view on that?
On this particular issue, I think the court is pretty final. It's a very clear, strong decision that this is the last word on what the current language of the law means. A lot of people didn't think that this challenge was going to have legs. Some people didn't think that the original NFIB challenge was going to have legs. So it's hard to say absolutely never. But I think that this issue, whether subsidies are available in all states, is definitively settled by the court's decision.
And I would just add...
Okay, you don't necessarily expect... Oh, go ahead.
No, this is Larry. I would just add, I mean, it's, I think with this law, particularly given the political divisiveness, we've seen these very fundamental legal challenges that go at the heart of the law. And it's hard to imagine any more of those coming. But this law will no doubt be litigated forever. I mean, just like any other complicated federal law is, whether in the health realm or elsewhere. I mean, if you look at environmental cases or ERISA cases, there will no doubt be reams of litigation over aspects of this law in the future.
That answers my question. Thank you.
Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press *1 on your telephone keypad. Your next question comes from the line of Tierney Sneed with Talking Points Memo. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks for having the call. The decision, of course, started out going into a lot about past reform and was really heavy on kind of the policy angle. For the policy people on the call, did the Supreme Court get how the policy and the economics of this law right? Were they, pretty on point in how they kind of interpreted how this law plays out? And secondly, were you surprised that they kind of framed the decision that way?
I'll just quickly say, this is Larry. I mean, it's, first of all, I think the court learned a whole lot about health economics between the last decision and this decision. And there was a remarkable amount of economics embedded in this decision. I don't know if Gary or Karen, you want to add anything?
Sure. This is Gary. I think this was how the case was argued to them. It makes a lot of sense if you're going to open up access, you have to have subsidies to go with it. And I think the court saw that. It's, I think this is sort of what people thought was going on, other than, I guess, a few.
Great. Tierney, does that help?
Yep.
Thanks.
Your next question comes from the line of Sabrina Eaton with Cleveland Plain Dealer. Your line is open.
Hi. If the decision had gone the other way, what would have been the consequences for consumers and health insurers? And were there a lot of contingency plans that you were aware of? And, you know, what would have happened, basically?
Well, I think this is Larry. I mean, I think the insurance industry is certainly breathing a sigh of relief this afternoon. I mean, the decision, if the decision had gone the other way, it would have really upended in insurance markets, and it would have erupted into chaos. And insurers are now all in on this law. You know, for consumers, I think as Molly would tell you, consumers mostly weren't paying any attention to the court case, but it certainly had huge consequences for the 6 million people who were already receiving subsidies and would have lost them if the case had gone the other way. Great.
Your next question comes from the line of Dan Kohlberg with Capital New York. Your line is open.
Hi, guys. Thanks for doing this. I had a quick question whether this ruling would affect executive orders regarding mandates. So, for example, the president delayed the employer mandate. Could the next president delay the individual mandate, you know, for 4 years or something along those lines? Or would this ruling say that's not part of Congress's intent?
I mean, I don't think any of us on the call are administrative law experts, but Mary Beth, do you have a view on that?
This case doesn't speak to that issue. You know, when the court makes a decision, they accept a very specific question or questions to decide, and they only accept what's before it. And so this case specifically was about whether subsidies could flow in the federally facilitated marketplace states, and so that's what the decision speaks to.
So it ties the administration's hand, the future administration's hands, but only to a point.
On this issue, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Your next question comes from the line of Warren Veith with Oklahoma Watch. Your line is open.
Hi, another politics question, which you've addressed a little bit already. In states like Oklahoma, where Republican officials have been adamantly opposed to almost every aspect of Obamacare and have shown no interest at all in creating a state-based exchange, will today's ruling change the political equation at all?
I don't think it changes the political equation on the exchanges relative to the status quo. I mean, if the decision had gone the other way, it would have put red state governors in a very difficult spot where they would have had to, choose between opposing Obamacare versus making sure that billions of dollars in subsidies were flowing to their residents. I think with this decision, governors are free to oppose the Affordable Care Act on political grounds, but that doesn't have consequences for the subsidies in the exchanges. Now, there's still the question of Medicaid. And Jen, do you want to just quickly go over the current numbers on kind of the Medicaid expansion and where we are?
Yes, this is Jennifer Tolbert. Currently, 30 states have expanded the Medicaid program, leaving 20 states that have not yet expanded Medicaid. There are discussions in several states across the country, and you know, it's unclear whether now that the law seems to be settled and the ACA is here to stay, whether that will affect any of the decisions by legislatures and governors across the country that have not yet expanded Medicaid. But clearly the Medicaid expansion can happen at any point. The 100% federal funding is available for one more year through 2016, and then after that it begins to phase down a bit. But the federal funding is still, there's still a great deal of federal funding available to states should they choose to implement the expansion.
And this is Karen Politz. I think there are other areas, and Oklahoma is one of the states, one of a handful of states that has declined to enforce any of the insurance market reforms and has left that to the federal government. So I think there are still options in several ways for states to decline to participate or to try to, you know, throw up other roadblocks to successful implementation.
Thanks.
Your next question comes from the line of Shannon Firth with MedPH Today. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Shannon. Thank you for doing this call. I was curious to know how you think this decision may affect the 1332 waiver, if at all.
Yeah, I mean, so just to briefly describe what 1332 waivers are for those who don't know. So this is a provision of the law, Section 1332, not surprisingly, that allows states to take very different approaches to accomplish the same goals as the Affordable Care Act beginning in 2017. And it's an opportunity for states to take a more conservative or more liberal approach after 2017 to, again, accomplish the same goals that are in the law. I think if the decision had gone the other way, Section 1332 waivers may have loomed quite large as a way for governors to provide financial help to their residents without seeming to go along with Obamacare, in much the same way that states have tried to implement the Medicaid expansion in a somewhat different way than originally intended. So I think Section 1332 waivers will be a big issue for the next administration. And while the conditions in the statute are quite stringent in terms of the goals that states would have to meet in doing a waiver, there may be some wiggle room there for a new administration, and Congress could certainly always change those conditions as well.
Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press *1 on your telephone keypad. Your next question comes from the line of Ricardo Alonso Zaldi with Associated Press. Your line is open.
Hi, Ricardo Alonso Zaldivar with AP. Sorry if this question might have been asked before, but what does this do for states that were maybe thinking of starting their own exchanges? Is it now more likely that they wouldn't do that? What does the picture look like going forward? Could some states, for example, now flip to federal?
Yeah. Hey, Ricardo. People will get your name right. People will get your name right eventually. So I think this removes a major incentive for states to set up their own exchanges. Again, if the decision had gone the other way, I think states would have scrambled to try and set up their own exchanges and keep the subsidies flowing. Now it may look like more of a hassle than an opportunity to states to move forward with that. I think there are some examples like Arkansas, you know, in particular because of the private option Medicaid approach, it might be attractive. But I think the bar will now be very high for states to set up their own exchanges. And if anything, we'll see some of the existing state-based exchanges decide to avoid some of the hassles, particularly of conducting eligibility and enrollment, and let the federal government handle that.
Follow up.
Yeah, please.
So, does that mean that you see like a shift to
you know, a nationwide federal exchange, basically, or would it be more kind of like a hybrid situation where the states do some, but then there's kind of like this nitty-gritty work of signing people up and determining eligibility that gets done by the feds?
Yeah, I think, and you know, we've already seen something of a hybrid approach with, you know, with some states running their own exchanges entirely and a number of other states acting as partnerships where they do some functions and the federal government does other functions. And I think in particular, as it's emerged, you know, the IT aspect of running an exchange and signing people up has proved to be very difficult. And while healthcare.gov isn't perfect, it seems to be working pretty well at this point. So I think, you know, the idea of letting the federal government handle eligibility and enrollment, but individual states handling outreach and plan management and consumer assistance may still be quite attractive. And those are the things where, you know, there's direct interface with consumers, which states may want to do themselves. So I think the idea of setting up an exchange has been so politicized from the start. But as the political temperature over the law, political temperature of the law in general drops, you may see more states wanting to at least handle some aspects of exchange functions.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Tierney Sneed with Talking Points Memo. Your line is open.
Sorry, I plugged in for a follow-up. At the beginning of the call, Larry, you said that while there's, you know, not much wiggle room for future administrations on this issue because of this ruling, there are certain ways that a future administration could pull the law to the left or the right. I know that's kind of a broad question, but briefly, you know, can you outline for me kind of some of the ways that they still could, a future administration could still move this law one way or the other?
Sure. And I guess I would differentiate, and I'll start and then others should jump in, but I would differentiate between, actual changes to the statute, which might be possible with a Republican White House and Republican control of Congress or vice versa, with Democratic control. And there I would see potentially the Cadillac tax being a big issue in the future, the state Section 32 waivers, which we talked about, the employer requirement, certainly some of the taxes like the medical device tax, and I think also the structure of the subsidies themselves. While the subsidies are now locked into law, there could certainly be debate over whether those subsidies should be made less generous or more generous, or the structure of the subsidies changing. Like, you know, rather than having them vary by income, have them be flat dollar amounts, like in some of the Republican replacement plans. And then there are a variety of administrative actions that an administration could take. I mean, this is a big, complicated law with a lot of discretion. In regulatory guidance. And Karen, do you have any thoughts on what kind of, you know, where, for example, you know, some regulatory decisions might go one way or the other?
Lots probably. There are, there's a sort of ongoing evolution of all kinds of kind of key definitional things. What do we mean by essential health benefits? How might those be defined more or less clearly? How should they be administered? In all the running of the consumer assistance services, whether those should continue to grow and develop or whether they would stay kind of, you know, hindered by funding and other constraints. I think, I don't know, if there's any number of interpretive issues that I think will be on the plate of any administration going forward. We're probably a long way from steady state implementation. Either way.
This is Gary Claxton. I would just add, like, the definition of minimum value and what employers have to offer to be considered to offer health insurance, what actuarial value means. The whole law is interpreted, it rests on a number of interpretations of key provisions in order to say what it is that meets certain tests or not. And obviously those tests can be changed. That's all done through administrative law, and can and most of it can be and most of it is not nailed down in statute, and so most of it can be reinterpreted.
Great. Next question.
Your next question comes from the line of Susan Jassy with The Lancet. Your line is open.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Someone from Oklahoma mentioned that Oklahoma is one of the states that is not enforcing consumer insurance protections. I'm wondering how many states are in that same boat and leaving the task to the feds, and is the federal government equipped to do the job? And are you afraid that this could be a way of sabotaging the law?
Karen, do you have those numbers off the top of your head?
We're just looking at each other. I think it's four states, but it might be five. It's not a lot. And I think so far CMS has been able to review the plans. There's essentially a dual system for insurance regulation now in these states, where insurers have to submit their products and their rates for review under the state law, and then have to submit them separately to the federal government to make sure that they pass muster with the ACA requirements. So I think it's a little cumbersome, to say the least, for those insurers. But as far as I know, CMS has been able to manage this with the help of contractors and with their own staff.
Thanks.
Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Your next question comes from the line of Richard Kirchner with Managed Care Magazine. Your line is open. Excuse me, Mr. Kirchner, please go ahead.
Hi, yes. Thank you for taking my question. Following up on the discussion about the states that run their own exchanges, would those states that decide to fall back onto the federal exchange see any changes in their overall insurance marketplaces, that is, the insurance marketplaces that include the exchanges but also go beyond the exchanges?
This is Larry Leavitt. No, a state using healthcare.gov, that affects how people sign up for marketplace coverage and subsidies. But certainly doesn't affect the outside market. And the outside market, there's really three components to it now. There's the ACA compliant right. market, where people are buying new coverage, and that coverage has to follow all the same rules as, or largely all the same rules as inside the marketplace. And then there are so-called grandfathered and grandmothered plans. The grandfathered plans existed, were plans that people purchased before the law passed, and grandmothered plans. The rules vary by state, whether they're allowing those plans, which were purchased after the law was passed but before January 1st, 2014, whether that coverage can continue or not. And in no cases can that grandmothered coverage continue past October of 2017. So I don't think a state kind of deferring to healthcare.gov for eligibility enrollment affects the outside market in any meaningful way. And there are, I think if the decision had gone another way, this model of using healthcare.gov but being called a state-based marketplace might have been quite controversial and certainly very consequential. I think now it's more of there are some administrative details to be worked out, like how user fee revenues get distributed between states and the federal government for financing marketplace operations. But it becomes a much less, a much less controversial mechanism and one that might be attractive to some of the state-based marketplaces.
Okay. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Fred Knapp with Net News. Your line is open.
Hello. You answered this in part when you were talking about how the law could move left or right, and you mentioned essential health benefits and consumer assistance services. But could you concretize that a little bit? Could you say where specifically the rubber meets the road on those and where the future battles could be?
C- Gary or Karen, you want to take that?
It's sort of hard to speculate. You could go off in a million directions. The essential health benefits right now we're at a kind of a holding pattern. The law specifies 10 categories of benefits, and then there was a question about whether those would be defined in detail. This administration declined to do that and instead deferred to a system of benchmark plans, so kind of trying to approximate what was already there and then tweaking it to where there were clear deficiencies. They promised that this would be something that would be revisited down the road, and we're kind of coming up on that. So we'll have to see. The whole question of consumer assistance is still very much developmental. The law requires that this be funded, kind of baked into the insurance system, funded out of the operating system of the exchanges. So far, federal and state, the funding decisions have been kind of ad hoc, and we're still seeing these programs develop and mature. So it's a very detailed law, and there are a lot of administrative decisions that will continue to need to be made. And until we get to something that begins to feel kind of familiar and routine, I think many aspects of the law could continue to be, you know, evolving.
Great. Well, why don't we take one more question?
There are no further questions at this time. Oh, okay. I turn the call back to Larry Levitt for closing remarks.
Great, thanks. Well, we won't take one more question. I think you all know how to find us, so if you do have further questions, certainly feel free to let us know. And just in conclusion, I would say that, with this court decision behind us, we move on to, some of the nitty-gritty implementation issues that are somewhat below the radar. And in particular, I think looking ahead to the next open enrollment period, where expectations are quite high that enrollment will grow. While the law has succeeded and done everything it set out to do up until now, to continue to succeed, it has to reach more uninsured and continue to sign people up. So thank you all for joining us. And as I said, feel free to get in touch if you have more questions.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.